Well, good morning, everyone. It's good to see so many people here for this talk this morning, which could be in some ways a bit of a sort of doom-laden thing, but I hope we're going to give it some sort of positive spin for you. But given that we're at a Christian gathering and given the title of the talk, I think it would be good to start with a chorus. So will you join with me in singing, "Give Me Oil in My Lamp"? Give me oil in my lamp. Give me oil in my lamp, I pray. Give me oil in my lamp, keep me burning. Keep me burning till the break of day. Sing Hosanna, sing Hosanna. Sing Hosanna to the King of Kings. Sing Hosanna, sing Hosanna. Sing Hosanna to the King. Friends, thank you for that. It does take me right back to church of yesteryear. I don't know how often that song has been sung at Greenbelt. The words to that song are taken from a parable that Jesus told, which is recorded in Matthew chapter 25, about the 10 wise and the 10 foolish virgins. And obviously, it would be impertinent of me to ask for, you know, how many people here fit into those categories. But the parable also does provide the title for our seminar here this morning and for our book, which is published this week, available in all good bookshops and on the on site as well. And so that book has just come out, and what you're getting this morning is a kind of condensed version of the book, which we're going to try and fit into an hour and also leave some time for questions. And Neil and I are both sort of new to this book writing business. This is our first book, and we've written it together. And it's an interesting process. Where the book came out on Monday. You could look on Amazon and get it. And by Wednesday, we had our first review on Amazon. So we're very excited about that. 5-star review from somebody. I don't know who it was. If you're here, please come and see us afterwards. We're very grateful for that. I also noticed on Wednesday that in the Amazon listing, there was also one book available used. I don't know if it was the same person. Anyway, you're getting two speakers for the price of one this morning. So you're getting me. My name's Andy Mellon. Just to describe myself very briefly, I'm a smallholder, former missionary, and Morris dancer. So those three things combined in one person. And here I have Dr. Neil Hollow, who's a research scientist, and he comes from Edinburgh, and he's looking for a job. So if anyone knows a job in research science, he's looking for that. So why write a book about these issues, about resource constraints, and why bring it to a Christian gathering like this? Well, we think this is an absolutely critical issue. The resource constraints that mankind is going to face in the years ahead are really going to affect everyone. So in a sense, everybody needs to be concerned about this. But why particular Christians? Well, it seems to me for Christians, the developing situation we're seeing with resource constraints starting to hit in various ways around the world, that situation provides the context in which we have to live, in which we have to work, in which we will worship, in which we will minister, and which we have to witness in the years ahead. And Neil and I have looked into these issues together over the last 8 to 10 years, and we really wanted to bring a kind of Christian perspective to this subject. Until recently, there was no other books looking at this particular issue from a Christian perspective. There were plenty of others looking at it from a sort of secular perspective. In actual fact, while we're writing the book, two others have come out. So there's one published in America by a guy called Ron Rhodes, which is called The Coming Oil Storm. And having read the book, it's a very, very good book in the sense of the analysis he's done is very spot on. Where we would sort of digress from him, his perspective, is when he starts tying in these kind of concerns into end times prophecy and making very specific predictions, which perhaps we would differ from him on. The other book that's come out recently is by a guy called Sam Norton. It's called Let Us Be Human, Christianity for a Collapsing Culture. Is Sam here today? He's often at Greenbelt, but that's another book which kind of complements ours and perhaps goes a little bit deeper into the theology. Anyway, the talk this morning is about what we sometimes describe as peak oil, and I'll go on to explain that a little bit later, and bringing a Christian perspective to that. If you're interested in what we talk about this morning, you want to read more, the book's for you, it's available. We're also doing a book signing in G-Books at 1 p.m. this afternoon. I'm not entirely sure why someone would want my signature on their book, but if you want to come and have a chat with me and Neil, do come and meet us there, and we can meet up and have a chat. So what we have for you this morning is both good news and bad news. The good news is that no analyst is saying that we're going to suddenly run out of oil. Nobody's saying that. The bad news is that we do face some difficult years ahead as we grapple with resource constraints in various ways, and particularly as we start to run out of oil. But I want to take us back a little way. I want to go back to September 2000. In September 2000, you may remember we had some fuel protests in this country. Started off by truckers and farmers who were worried about the high price of oil, and they started off by blockading some oil refineries in Cheshire and various parts of the country. And truck drivers decided they weren't going to cross the picket lines. And in very, very quick succession, there was a snowball effect which started to cause shortages of oil and fuel across the country. And this sort of built up into quite a crisis in a very short space of time. You'll have remembered earlier this year how people sort of got into panic buying. The same thing happened in the year 2000. But it was worse and it was deeper. So lots of garage forecourts were sold out, closed off. People couldn't get fuel. And things started to get worse quite quickly. Sir Peter Davis, who was the head of Sainsbury's at that time, wrote to Tony Blair, who was the Prime Minister, saying that they could not guarantee that food would be kept on the shelves of Sainsbury's, because within a couple of days, their trucks were running out of oil. They couldn't guarantee getting to the stores. And the situation quickly got a lot worse. Now, the politicians got people in a room. Tony Blair read the Riot Act, apparently, and heads were banged together. And in a sense, within a few days, the whole thing sort of started to fizzle out and the problem was solved. That was a brief political episode, but it kind of demonstrates, in a sense, our dependence on oil. We're very, very dependent in our Western developed countries on oil. Oil was formed thousands, millions of years ago when ancient organic matter was pressure cooked deep underground through geological processes. Over many years, the soil and the rock above was eroded or it's pushed up from below, and in various places that oil came to the surface and it came into contact with humankind. So there have been tales in the ancient worlds of places where you could find oil seeping out of the ground. We have in the book of Genesis chapter 6, Noah seals the ark with pitch, which was a kind of tarry compound from oil. But really, the start of the oil age, when oil started to be drawn out of the ground by industrial processes, it was exactly 153 years ago when it started. There was a guy called Edwin Drake in Pennsylvania, and he adapted a salt well drilling rig and struck oil on August 27th, 1859. There was probably some other exploration going around at the same time in Baku in Azerbaijan, but those things sort of grew up together. So in a sense, this is kind of the birthday of the oil industry. Now, Edwin Drake never really made any money out of it. He didn't really know what to do with all this sudden oil that he managed to get out of the ground. And the first years of the oil industry were pretty slow going. But what people quickly discovered was that oil was an amazingly energy-intense substance. And they found lots and lots of different uses for it. If you think about a car running out of fuel, it takes two or three people to push that car to the side of the road. It takes an enormous amount of energy to move a car along by human power. But you just pour a gallon of petrol or diesel into the tank, and it will speed that car along for 50, 60, 70 miles. Oil is incredibly energy intensive, and it's become very, very useful to us. In fact, you could describe the 20th century as the age of oil. From the beginning, when cars were invented, until mass production of cars started in 1908, we've become incredibly more and more dependent on oil. And also alongside that, other fuels like gas, coal, uranium, all of these things which we dig out of the ground. But oil is the most critical source of energy because it fuels transport. Not just our personal transport, but the transportation of goods, food, all these different things around the globe. So what do we mean by this phrase, peak oil? You may have heard that in news reports, you may have read it in the newspapers. Well, there's a technical explanation for that. It's the point at which half the oil in the world has gone. But people put a greater meaning on it than that. After the production of oil has peaked and goes into decline, there are all sorts of consequences which come from that. There's less oil around for us to use, and that is going to potentially have lots of consequences for us. Now, the first analysis of how much oil there may be and how long it would take for that to run out was started back in the 1950s by a guy called Marion King Hubbert. He was an oil geologist. And at that time, he was very much a voice sort of crying in the wilderness, a lone voice talking about how oil was going to run out and why we needed to be prepared for that. But it isn't like that anymore. Lots and lots of people are saying we have this problem ahead of us. From the American government to the chief economist of the International Energy Agency to writers like James Howard Kunstler. And he said, we've been using oil like there's no tomorrow. Now there may not be. At this point, I'm going to hand over to Neil to sort of bring us up to date for the last few years.
Thanks very much, Andy. Nice to see so many of you here, huddle around in the cold. So I'm going to try and update you since 2008 and since we've done the book. And I'll just try and whip through it because we want to leave time for questions. I'm sure you've got loads already. We take questions at the end, by the way. So in 2008, the oil price reached an all-time high of $147 a barrel. And then, as was almost always happened since since the Second World War, there was a recession. All but two recessions have been linked to the oil price. Don't ask me which ones, I can't remember. And the oil price then dropped back. As demand fell, then the oil price dropped back to $35 a barrel, roundabout. And then it started going up quite quickly after that. And it's been on an upward trend ever since. But it's also been very volatile since then, with big swings. Even on a daily basis, it's very volatile. Now, factors that could have been affected the price included those: the Arab Spring, economic recovery, quantitative easing. There's a theory that the banks printing money and giving it to banks. Well, it's the Bank of England printing money and giving it to banks, as well as speculation. But at the back of this, there's a tightness of supply. Supply is only just keeping up. At the same time, some new fields have been found. So there's been big finds off Brazil. However, if you work out, if you divide the known reserves of these new finds by how much we use a day, which is about 86 million barrels a day, then you get that 6 months. If we used it all immediately, you know, it would give us 6 months. At the same time, the Arctic has been melting, and this has opened up new avenues of exploration. However, to the best of my knowledge, they've not found anything. Not very little off the Falklands as well. And in 2010, the International Energy Agency acknowledged that conventional oil has peaked. Conventional oil supply has peaked. So that means, by that we mean all the easy to extract stuff has gone, has peaked. And we're into unconventional oils and oil that is in very deep water in the Arctic, et cetera, to make up the supply. At the same time, over this period, a controversial new energy source has appeared, which is unconventional gas, and a new word has entered the dictionary called fracking. This is a method of extracting gas trapped in shales and sandstones, and this has had enormous effects on prices in the US, but not elsewhere. Here, gas prices tend to be linked to that of oil, and my gas price went up by 30% in 2011, and that was largely due to the wholesale price of gas going up. at the very important point to make, at the whole, all of this, all the way along, conventional sources of energy, the energy return has been falling. It takes energy to make energy. You have to, it's not a, that's not a very good scientific way of thinking about it, but to extract oil or gas or coal, uranium from the ground takes energy, obviously, and then to treat it and then to transport it. This has been falling for the last century. When we had gushers in Pennsylvania, you get 100 return. If you put one unit of energy in, you get 100 back from oil. All the last century has been falling, and it's, I mean, figures vary, but it's definitely below 20 to 1 now. So that means what we've got ahead of us in the future isn't going to go as far. We're running, in the book I put it, you're running on a treadmill and you're having to run faster to stand still. Since we brought the book out, of course, this whole area is just moving all the time, and the book is rapidly out of date, not that I'd stop you buying it, but anyway, I'll just give you a brief, Tracy, and put it in plus and minuses, depends what which is which, depends on your point of view to a certain extent. First, the negatives. None of these pluses and minuses are absolutely mega important. They're all little things that are important and incremental, I would say. There's been a pushback against renewables, not just here, but in Germany as well. Merkel is regretting her move on nuclear, but and has tried to limit solar uptake. Not much focus on energy efficiency at the level required. Green New Deal remains untested. Renewable heat incentive keeps being delayed. No acknowledgement of peak oil by any government. Please let me know if you know of any exceptions to that. A politician has mentioned it while they're in power. The oil price has moved upwards, as I say, with large fluctuations. No change, no progress on a climate treaty. The Arctic ice continues to melt. Continuing high levels of denial in America about climate change and energy security. We're back to drill, baby, drill, with a very, very poor level of debate, I think. Continuing unrest of the Middle East, obviously, and still threat of attack on Iran. Peak oil is a myth, thanks, George. This article in The Guardian appeared, and we had a look at it, and we had a look at the background. It's based on one report, which, is, again, is based on the US Geological Survey, which has this reputation going back all the way to Hubbard about being very optimistic about resources generally and oil in particular. Positives. These are very minor. We're trying to be positive. Both car sales and fuel sales fell in 2011 in the UK. The fuel sales, is, the best of my knowledge, is the first time it's fallen for a very long time, and that is quite interesting. Record renewable energy production here, and particularly in Germany, where they're going to phase out their feed-in tariff when they reach 52 gigawatts of solar installed capacity, and that could be reached in about 3 years, maybe 2 years. They're still exporting. When they phased out the nuclear, people said they won't export to countries around them. They have to import and they have to use coal or whatever. They're closing power stations, some of them permanently. They're still exporting, but not as much to the surrounding countries. There's still a lot of support for renewables in government, even if they're governments generally, if they're split on the issue. The transition movement, which we'll be coming back to a bit later, hasn't gone away, and it's beginning to grow and deepen its reach. The Green Investment Bank and the Happiness Index have been launched, and those are, you know, quite important. They're small things, but they're quite important. A different way about thinking about the economy. We're not going to mention that. I've just come from a talk with Douglas Alexander, which was quite interesting. And someone asked a question on this, and they don't get it. But anyway, a different way of thinking about the economy, which we've got in the book, but we're not talking about this morning. And shale gas production in the States is now slipping because the price, shale gas production puts a floor under prices. It takes a lot more energy to extract, and that costs a lot of money. And what's happened is the price has fallen of gas in the States dramatically. And of course, it's not worth extracting shale gas. So there's been a downturn in shale gas extraction, which would mean the gas price will go up. So you're going to seesaws in price. Now, I'm doing the next section as well. I know there's people here who know a lot more about theology than me. Now, we cover the theology in the book. We're not theologians, okay? So I know there's going to be people, I can know people here who know a lot more about theology. And I'm just going to give a very brief summary of what we put in the book, okay? Now, we don't regard this, and the title chapter indicates this, we don't regard this as the last word on peak oil theology. And of course, the Bible doesn't talk about oil in the sense that we were thinking about it. When the Bible talks about oil, it's talking about olive oil, not diesel oil. So which is a funny story about Rob Hopkins, which has come to me, the founder of the transition movement. He went into a pub and he got talking to this guy about peak oil. And the guy agreed with him that there's a serious, serious problem, blah, 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 blah. And they got talking. And Rob thought he was making a lot of progress on talking to this guy about it. And it turned out the guy thought he was talking about teak oil for polishing things. However, we think there are areas where we, although the Bible doesn't mention oil as such, that we think that a number of areas where we can apply theology to a degree. I'm just going to briefly go through them, and you might want to pick me up on the end. We'll probably say we don't know the answer, but you can try. So dominion, the whole idea of dominion versus stewardship in Genesis 1 and 2, if we really are going to exploit everything, and we think of dominion, we exploit anything, it doesn't matter if we destroy the planet. This comes in with some of the end time teaching, which I'll come to in a minute. If we think we're stewards, then we take care of what we use and we don't rob future generations. And we think the Bible leans more towards the stewardship idea, and there's some verses in Genesis that would lead to indicate that. And there's also, even if you went for dominion, there's other verses in other parts of the Old Testament which suggest care for creation is part of God's will. Justice. A lot of what we read in the Old Testament prophets could easily apply to us today. We've benefited from cheap energy. Our whole society is built on it. And so we have a sort of advantage, financial and economic and social advantage that a lot of other people in the third world don't, or developing world, sorry, don't. And there's another question. Obviously, we're doing great damage to the environment, not just climate change, but also places like the Niger Delta. It's very interesting when the disaster happened in the Gulf of Mexico. The Americans were obviously outraged about the pollution that BP caused, and it was people killed, and the pollution was a tremendous problem. But in the Niger Delta, that's going on every single day, and it has been for years. How can you tell where your oil comes from in your tank? You can't. It could be from the Niger Delta. Human wisdom and frailty. In the book, we look a little bit at Ecclesiastes and what the teacher in Ecclesiastes can talk to us about materialism, partly, but also being too clever. We think we can engineer our way out of it. There's a tendency to think we can engineer our way out of a problem. Now, neither Andy and I think that. Not totally. There's technology can help, but are we too clever? And also in Ecclesiastes, it's just a hint of it was written at a time when is this as good as things are going to get in Israel? And things were downhill from then on in a sort of materialism sense. And so we sort of raise that issue a bit. Coming on to the New Testament, Jesus taught a lot about materialism, and I went to a very, very full seminar on simplicity. In Luke 12, he was asked to intervene in an inheritance dispute, but didn't, in the way that the person was expecting, but he talked about the dangers of materialism and being reliant on God for our everyday needs. And this, in the book, leads us thinking about simplicity, and we recommend a book by Richard Foster. Well, there's a couple of books, but one's out of print, but you could certainly get it called Simplicity. Another thing we examine in the book is the idea of celebration, and we, oil has given us a good life, but we should all, one thing the transition movement asked us to do is to celebrate when we do something. And Jesus, when you look at Jesus, Jesus loved celebration. He loved going to parties, and a lot of his teaching was done at meal times. And so we should celebrate as well, celebrate the end of the oil age and moving on, and celebrate when we achieve things as we move away from oil. So that's another idea we brought up. And then there's the rather obvious stuff in Acts about community and sharing. Material goods are going to become scarce and expensive. We don't need to own everything. You could share lawnmowers, maybe even cars. And there's people doing that now in a small way. But it becomes more necessary. And we need to learn to hold our possessions looser as Christians. And then we have a little look at the end time teaching, because sort of the whole idea of peak oil does lend itself to the idea of apocalypse. There's no doubt about that. And there's a lot of Christians. There's a lot of stuff in the secular peak oil. There is quite a lot of stuff in the secular peak oil movement about apocalypse. And one apocalyptic Christian book, as I say. So we've had a little look at that in the book. you know, there's a number of Christians who made exact predictions to the day and time of Jesus's return, which is not scriptural, and of course they haven't got it right. And most New Testament scholars, who, like Michael Green and N.T. Wright, think this is pernicious nonsense. Their criticism of this teaching is it goes against everyday faith and social involvement. Whilst peak oil could lead to the collapse of industrial civilization, that may not be the same as the apocalypse and the return of Christ. You're on.
So what does this thing about peak oil, what does it mean in practical terms? How is it going to affect us in the years ahead? The American government commissioned a guy called Robert Hirsch to give a report on what it might mean for the American economy, the American people. And he came out with a comprehensive report a few years ago. I'll just give you one quote from it. "The peaking of world oil production presents the world with an unprecedented risk management problem. As the peak is approached, fuel prices and price volatility will increase dramatically, and without timely mitigation, the economic, social, and political costs will be unprecedented." And as Neil has said, there's some pretty apocalyptic warnings out there. Because of our dependence on oil, and because it's starting to run short, and because other energy sources can't really fill the gap, then we are in for some difficult times ahead. Now, what we've tried to do in our book is to set out three different scenarios which may come true in the future. And it's very, very difficult to start doing futurology. You can very easily look stupid because within a year or two, things have veered off in a different direction and your predictions look out of the book completely. But what we try to do is to set out three possible scenarios, and I'm hedging this round with as many caveats and provisos as I possibly can, because it is very, very difficult to predict the future. But some of these things may happen. So I'll give you the first one. The first one is the optimistic scenario. This is what the scientists think, that we can get round the problem of oil production peaking because we'll find other ways to get energy. Science will provide the answers. There will be a technological fix, and things will get better. So I'll just give you a brief taste of that. The graphs show that oil production did peak and go into decline, but few people noticed. By 2015, after several years of high oil prices, it was demand that peaked as consumers found ways to do without it. A series of summits at the UN resulted in the adoption of a legally binding agreement to reduce demand for oil by 5% per year. And once agreed, people found it easier than expected. Within 2 years, the automotive industry had introduced a number of innovative vehicles which used far less fuel. Renault extended the range of electric cars with new battery technology. People still flew, but less often. The high fuel price had put half the world's airlines out of business, and flying was very expensive. Some aircrew even retrained as insulation fitters. The government's emergency insulation scheme, introduced in 2017, was a great success. Millions of homes were insulated, using huge numbers of previously unemployed people to do compulsory energy audits and upgrading homes to the new efficiency standards. With the huge North Sea and Irish Sea wind farms now in place, renewable energy production had soared by 2020. Green energy was whizzing around Europe on the new supergrid, and with smart meters in every home, the supply of energy could be managed far more efficiently. As renewable energy came on stream, most of the gas and coal plants were mothballed. It wasn't all good news, though. Food prices had rocketed and some items were in short supply. And while carbon emissions were continually falling, the problems from historical emissions of CO2 continued. And it goes on in that vein. So a very positive scenario. Yes, there'll be problems, but we may cope. The second scenario is perhaps a little bit darker. We call this disintegration. The Saudi Arabians kept very quiet about it, but in 2014, production from the world's largest oil field went into steep decline. As oil demand started to outstrip supply, the price moved upwards once again and kept on going. By 2015, it had reached $250 per barrel as supply tightened. The problem for many people was not the price of fuel, but simply not being able to get hold of it. Panic buying had led to petrol shortages and queues at the pumps, and the supply of fuel became intermittent. What was worse was the confusion. Governments did not seem to have any answers or even an explanation for it, with ministers blaming the oil companies for lack of investment and oil price speculators for profiteering. In off-the-record conversations with journalists, they blamed China and their oil supply contracts it had signed with Iran and other Middle Eastern countries. Nobody talked about geology or declining production. Inconsistent fuel supplies played havoc with the supermarket's distribution logistics, so that while there may be plenty of food sitting in warehouses and cold stores, often shop shelves are empty. When delivery lorries did arrive, Tesco staff found themselves having to operate a rough-and-ready rationing system to maintain order. Farmers' markets were suddenly the busiest places, with stores being swept clean of produce in a few minutes of frantic selling. I wish. The cold winter of 2017 was when things started to go badly wrong. With the pound dropping in value, the utility companies were unable to afford consistent imports of gas, and energy was rationed. Many thousands of older people succumbed to hypothermia and other ailments in their own homes. Trees started disappearing from urban parks and gardens as desperate people chopped them up for fuel. Even water supplies became erratic as companies struggled to obtain energy to treat water. The year 2018 saw the first food riots in cities across the country, beginning a lengthy period of civil unrest. By the end of the year, families living in the country were starting to find relatives from the cities arriving on their doorsteps. Nephews, cousins, sometimes whole families, needing a place to stay just for a few weeks until things settle down. In 2020, London, Edinburgh and other cities saw the return of smog after 70 years. And it goes on like that. Not a pleasant scenario to look at. The third scenario is what we've called muddling through. It's perhaps somewhere in between the other two scenarios. And it sort of details, and I won't read it this time because we're running out of time, but it details how we could possibly cope with things if we changed our behaviour a little bit, if we muddled through and sort of managed to sort of get through without major wrenching change. So all three of those scenarios are kind of flawed and they're simplistic, but elements of them could be true. We could breeze through. I doubt it, to be honest. We could have total economic disintegration, and I don't know whether that's true or not. It could be that we'll muddle through. But what could happen is that we think about what's happening, what may lie ahead, and change our behaviour now, and start to plan for energy descent, start to think about using less energy. And that's what the transition movement, which I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with, that's what that is about. And Neil's going to come and talk to us, give us a brief introduction to that now.
How many people here are involved in the transition movement? Some of you. How many people have heard of the transition movement? Most of you. Right. Well, I'm just going to briefly say, for the few people who haven't, I think, the transition movement was founded by Rob Hopkins when he had a talk of the teak oil fame, who went to a talk by Professor Colin Campbell of the Association for the Study of Peak Oil. And in Ireland, he and his students tried to imagine life with oil, and found it quite difficult, and realised how dependent they were. So when he moved back to the UK, he lived in Totnes, and he set about doing something about it. And he called it transition to mark the idea that we're transitioning from a carbon-addicted lifestyle to a sort of lifestyle where we're in harmony with our resources. Concepts caught on like wildfire, really, and people were contacting him around the country, asking him to form transition groups, and now there's nearly 500 worldwide. And what we like about it, we've both been involved in it a bit, respectively, is its positive vision. And it says we are the solution, not that we are the problem. Traditional environmentalists try and sort of scare us into action, and I don't think that's worked. And the transition movement has a different way, a positive way of looking at it. Now, it's a social movement, and it's not even primarily environmental, but its primary aim is to decarbonise local communities, making them resilient against shocks caused by climate change and peak oil. to call yourself a transition city, village, whatever, even university, Edinburgh University is a transition university, you have to accept climate change and peak oil are problems, and you have to follow their guidelines to start. They have a 12-point program. It's a bit like AA. Beyond that, how you meet the transition aims are up to you for the obvious reasons, and every community is different. So, what have they achieved? Well, they have a small office in Totnes, but that's by and large their only sort of permanent presence. In the early years, they worked on low-hanging fruit. So a lot of food is a huge problem with peak oil. But it's one of the easiest, one of the easiest ones to start doing something about, I guess. So they sort of set up projects using underused gardens and setting up orchards in Totnes and Edinburgh, Fife, etc. Energy efficiency, working with people to reduce their energy efficiency. There's a scheme going up. There's been a scheme in Edinburgh with Scottish Government money. As the movement has matured, it's got more ambitious. So they're setting up businesses now, co-ops mainly, bakeries and local energy co-ops. And there's one in here in there's a local energy co-op here in Cheltenham. And they had some interaction with local politics. This can be seen in the first film. They made two films, Transition 1 and Transition 2, though the results on that have been mixed. So they're not a really political movement. More recently, they've turned their attention to economics, and they're just starting to discuss a new economics, how an economic system would work without oil. And this work is ongoing, and this is bound to take them in a non-localised, more political way. They've been in the news now and again. The first one was over the land share. Hugh Fearnley Whittingstall, who you may have heard of, featured a scheme in Totnes, launched by Transition Totnes, on his programme, and inspired by it, set up land share. So land share is you go to a website and it matches people who have gardens that they don't want to look after with people who want to grow food who don't have gardens. Very simple idea. They do other things on the website as well, but that's the basis of it. And the second was launching a local currency. This has been covered on Radio 4. The local currency idea is, Rob Hopkins calls it like a bucket with holes in. So if you have a supermarket in your town, most 80% of the money leaves the town. Whereas if you have a local currency and local shops will accept that currency, it's a way of keeping the money in the town or the city or whatever. It can't leak out of holes in the bucket because it won't fit, because you can only use it locally. This was based on lets. There's been local currencies all over the world. It's had mixed effects. A lot of the Transition Lewis launched a local currency, it immediately sold out on eBay. They were selling them on eBay for vast amounts of money because it was a collector's item. It's technically a voucher for legal reasons. Bristol is going to launch one. I don't know if there's anyone here from Bristol, but they're launching one this year, supposedly. And that will be the biggest one yet. It will cover 1 million people. Is the life beyond the transition movement? Possibly. We haven't come across many people who are doing what transition does who are not in the transition movement, but there are some. So Ashton Hayes in Cheshire is a community that's trying to reduce their carbon emissions for climate change reasons. Another example is Willits in California. Looked at the Willits California website, and it looks like a transition model. They're aimed at peak oil as well, and it's very much transition. The problem in finding non-transition groups is that they keep joining the transition movement. So, for example, Linlithgow had a very active climate change group. Now they've just become a transition Linlithgow. There's been some criticism of transition movement from both left and right, climate deniers and peak oil deniers, and left people who think it's not going far enough. In terms of Christianity and the transition, we found, and maybe we'll be corrected at the end, but we found no formal links. We can find no formal links between the transition movement and churches, but we have found anecdotally lots of Christians who are involved in the transition movement. The sort of community seems to go very well with Christianity, the community action. So that's me.
Yeah, I'm not involved in a transition movement directly at the moment, but I have been to a few transition events, and what always strikes me about them is the very sort of positive vision there seems to be there. There seems to be a buzz and an excitement about this whole concept of transition, which is exciting, it's good, and it's much more positive than some of the sort of Friends of the Earth, Green Party type environmental doom mongering that has been going on in the past. Right, we're going to try and ground this into practical things that you can do. We tried to explain what this thing might mean, what energy shortages might look like in the years ahead, but what can we do about it? What can you do in your personal life to try and mitigate the problems that are coming our way? Here's five things you could do. The first thing is you've got to reduce your use. Try and remember that. It's a catchy phrase. Reduce your use of energy, particularly in the home. The two areas where we use energy the most are in the home and in transport. And if you reduce your use of those things, you are going to be less affected when shortages come and when high prices come. So you need to insulate your house as much as you possibly can. You need to stop that heat leaking out. You need to possibly think about generating electricity as well. Both Neil and myself have put solar panels on to generate electricity. I know other people have done that for very sound economic reasons. The way the government has set things up, it does make economic sense to invest your money in these things at the moment, as well as, you know, for very, very good sort of green reasons. Second thing you need to do is reduce your use of energy through transport. We need to be rethinking our relationship with the car and how dependent we are on it. And that perhaps today is a very good example of how dependent we are on the cars, because we're not allowed to bring our cars on and we've all had to carry our stuff off the site this morning. We are hugely dependent on the petrol engine and the diesel engine. And yet, how will we cope? How will we manage to live when oil runs short and we can't get oil to run our cars, or when oil is very, very expensive? We've got to start thinking about these things now and start maybe thinking about repatterning our life so that we're less dependent on the car. Thirdly, I think we need to be content with less stuff. And obviously this connects very clearly in with some of the teaching of Jesus. You know, he talks in the Sermon on the Mount about seeking first the kingdom of God and not worrying about other things. His phrase in Luke 17, where he tells the guy, asks him to intervene in a debate, he says, "A man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions." A hugely challenging sentence for our culture. Life is not about stuff, and yet we use energy to make stuff, to store stuff, to get rid of stuff. There's a huge amount of energy embodied in the stuff that we use. Of course, we need stuff to a certain extent, but we're using far too much of the planet's resources. Fourthly, I think we need to share the journey. We need to connect with other people who are thinking in the same way in order to encourage one another and reinforce our need to do these things. The culture around us is using up the planet at an unsustainable rate, and we need to get ourselves together with people who can challenge that and encourage each other to challenge that. And I think fifthly, we need to grasp these issues. We need to look at them and try and understand them a bit more. Maybe coming to this talk is the start for you. Maybe you're a long way down that road. Maybe reading a good book would help you. I can recommend one. But there are plenty of books which deal with this issue from a secular viewpoint and can sort of give you a different perspective on it. We need to kind of try and understand this whole area, because it is going to be so critical in the years ahead. So those are things you can do personally. Neil's going to come up with five things your church could do.
Actually, I don't think I have much. I think we're going to get to questions.
No, go for it. Go on.
Right. Well, briefly, very briefly, the first thing perhaps is to sort of raise awareness. So in our church, we show Transition 1. And I'd recommend Transition 1 more than Transition 2, because it's sort of low-hanging fruit and it's slightly more explanation about the problem. So we showed that, and about a third of the adults saw it. We showed it in a central screening, and we also went around some of the home groups, though on an informal basis. On transport, we've done a simple transport survey in the church. You've got to rethink. Both Andy and I go to gathered churches where people come from miles around by car, largely. So that isn't going to be possible. In the book, we kind of raise... We don't have all the answers, okay? In the book, I wouldn't claim we have all the answers. And we raise the issue and raise some questions in the church in the book on how you're going to get to church. But a car survey, we did a simple survey, which we give in the book, a transport survey, and that could be a way into car sharing and encouraging people to cycle. Another thing we've done in our church is had a cycle mechanic come along during the service. Anyone who wants their bike maintained for free by a professional cycle mechanic can have it done for free. Energy, again, reduce the church's energy. Monitor it on a weekly basis. Have a target. Can you switch to LEDs? Standby, heating, secondary glazing, insulation in the roof. A lot of churches can do that and haven't, I think, in my experience. Chemicals and materials is much more difficult. Can you recycle? Another thing we've done is our church is to... we've got the church website software allows a forum, so we've set up a forum for lens swap and share, so people can go online and post stuff. But you could use an old-fashioned notice board. Food, do you have to always pop down the supermarket? Could the church get an allotment? Could they find space to grow food? Can people with large cars and donate food? That's where I'm going to leave. We've got a bit more, but I think I'd quite like to move to questions, because I'm sure you've got millions of questions. So there's a roving mic. Does this... That works as well, yeah. Do you want to... I'll go here. Do you want to go there?
If you want to put your hand up if you've got a question, the roving mic will come to you, and then Neil will give you an answer.
Right, yeah.
Hello. I'm down here.
Where are we
to
looking?
To your right.
Hello. Say who you are, and yeah.
Julian Gray from York. Thank you very much for your talk. It was interesting. I'd never heard of the transition movement before in my life.
Oh,
so,
right, okay.
So there we go. There's a convert for you. I live in an old-fashioned 1910 house with solid brick walls, and I do get amused by the number of cavity insulation salesmen that come by. But, of course, I'm a little bit stuck. There are quite a lot of things that I cannot do.
Yeah.
And what do I do? Do I sell the house and build another one? It's a bit of a conundrum for us in the society that we live in, because make, do and mend, live in an inefficient house. I mean, this applies to a lot of areas, like your car. Should you keep your car or get rid of it? Because if you get rid of it, you would take energy to get rid of it, etc. What's your thinking on this?
In the book, we've done a bit on this, because I live in an 1853 stone house that actually has a cavity, but it has hurdle in the middle. We had a window put in our bathroom, so they were amazed. The people who put the window in showed it to us. I should have photographed it at the time, but I didn't. So we can't fill the cavity, though I'd have qualms about filling the cavity, because it's all lime, my house, and it breathes. It would make it less breathable. But there is insulation you could put on the inside, and we do detail that in the book briefly. There is another place to look is Historic Scotland. They're doing a lot of research on making ancient buildings more energy efficient, and they're putting all the stuff online. So you go to the website, and it's all scientific. They get universities, you know, it's all scientifically done with proper energy monitoring. So I've used the cheapest way of doing it, and it's slightly involved because it involves redecorating, is to use insulating lining paper. And there's two grades. There's a cheapo grade and there's a more expensive grade. So you put this stuff on, get the more expensive grade. You put this stuff. It does seem reasonably effective. It's definitely warmer since I've done it, and the rooms warmer. But the problem is you need to put more paper on top, because it doesn't look quite. And then you paint it. You know what I mean? Aesthetically, you need to put lining paper on top, normal lining paper.
Who's next?
Hi, I'm Beth Guttridge, Transition Town, Cheltenham.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
we actually had external insulation put on our house because we didn't have a cavity. But I wanted to ask you a bit about the heart and soul aspect of transition, which is something that I think is quite unique to transition, of saying we want to change all the external things, but we recognise that this has got to have an internal transformation to ourselves if we're going to actually sustain this. So have you got any thoughts about how Christians can be involved in supporting that? I'm speaking as somebody who is involved in the Heart and Soul group, but slightly thinking, how do we do this?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, I think, as we said earlier, that what is exciting about the transition movement is the kind of the positive vision at the heart of it, that okay, we're facing this problem of resource constraints and we're facing climate change, but life could be better. We could actually engineer our way to a more pleasant culture, a less busy culture, if we think carefully about it. Now, it seems to me that there's quite a lot of overlap there with some of the stuff in the Bible about the kingdom of God. You know, the kingdom of God is a positive vision which we start to see coming into being now. It's not just something, you know, for a different dimension in the future. It seems to me, you know, and there's been quite a bit of talk about this on site this weekend. N.T. Wright yesterday was speaking about this, that the kingdom of God comes into being when we bring God's values to this world and start to live as God's people. It seems to me there's a huge amount of overlap there in terms of positive thinking with a kind of positive vision of the transition movement. A lot of people in transition would not share Christian values. I think you know that. But it seems to me there is an overlap there, which is something that could be worked on.
I'll just add a little bit to that, and that is in the book we talk about meditation, the Christian discipline of meditation, and the idea of meditating on your future from a Christian perspective, using scripture or whatever, but using it specifically to think about finding passages in the Bible that mesh with, not depletion because they don't exist, but that are relevant, and then using the discipline of meditation. And we'd recommend Richard Foster's book, Celebration of Discipline, which teaches you how to do that.
Gentleman there.
George.
Yeah, George Rice from Wolverhampton. taking the subject matter to the other end, to the money end of things, every other day seems to be a story in the newspaper about fuel bills, and they generally say something negative about renewables, and the reason that fuel bills are going up is because of the cost of renewables. And I've seen lots and lots of different figures. I think there was an official figure from Ofgem saying that the cost of renewables to the average person who pays their bills is about £80 a year. But I don't know if that's a correct figure, and I don't know if you've got any perspective when people say renewables, they're far too expensive, what the real cost of renewables to the average householder is.
It's a lot. I think it's a lot less than £80. I mean, it was that Tom Heap on Panorama. I mean, I didn't see the programme, but I heard about it, and it was an absolute disgrace. And actually, if you go on the BBC's website, there is a full retraction on that programme. They said they got it factually wrong. They said that almost all the price increases in 2011 was due to renewable energy, and that is just totally untrue. And actually, they have retracted, and it is on their website. I looked. It's a lot. I think it's a lot less than £80. But, I mean, in a sense, I mean, I know for middle class people, I still think energy is quite cheap. I mean, I know for the poorer people, energy is expensive. But as a moral issue, why should this be cheap for us? We have buggered up the planet. Why should it be cheap for us to put it right? Why? What moral basis do we have for that? But at the same time, and in the book we haven't covered, there's no time to cover text this morning, but tradable energy quotas, the way around rising energy prices, and I think we will have to do this eventually, is to introduce a carbon ration and have a tradable carbon ration. It's the only way of redistributing and making sure poorer people are not hit by inevitable price increases. But we cover it in the book.
Lady at the back there.
Hello. I just wondered if you could expand a bit on when you said that organisations like Greenpeace and Friends of the Earth have kind of doom-mongered, because like, I'm part of Transition Loughborough, and I like the sort of local, practical, get-on-with-it sort of aspect of transition, but I guess I don't see that as being versus political action. I kind of saw them as complementary, so I just wondered if you could.
Yeah, I probably caricatured it slightly there, but I think there's a kind of traditional environmentalism which tend to be campaigning against things, you know, stop the whaling, stop the, you know, damaging the climate and that sort of thing. With transition seems to have switched that round and put a positive vision on it, that we are working towards a better future together. I think this whole area of peak oil and resource constraints, it really does lend itself to kind of doom-mongering. And you can go on websites, you can read books, particularly from America, which are very, very kind of apocalyptic viewpoints. James Howard Kunstler's book is particularly sort of, you know, in that kind of respect. So, whereas traditional environmentalism was kind of trying to, in a sense, scare people, well, this is the future we're heading towards if we don't do something. Transition is more, well, this is where we could be if we plan for it and thought carefully and work together. But I think that's the kind of different balance. I hope that answers the question. Where are we next?
Hi, my name's Jennifer. I'm a landscape architect, and so I'm really interested in the ideas of transition and food security, and particularly kind of permaculture and forest gardening and edible landscapes and edible gardens, and personally and professionally. And I was just interested in the fact that you're a smallholder, and are you putting into practice things like permaculture practices, forest gardening, organic, you know, and what is it like being a smallholder and looking at your growing and thinking about oil production,
yeah,
well, oil use?
Yeah, I mean, the whole area of food production is incredibly energy intense. Fertilizer is made from gas and uses energy in its production as well. I've always been involved in agriculture, so a smallholder is where I've sort of started as a food producer. So yeah, I'm registered organic with the Soil Association, and I try and farm that way because it uses less of the planet's resources. And I'm gathering some of the ideas from permaculture and forest gardening. I'm reading lots of stuff about it and trying to put it into practice in a small scale. I think there's a lot to learn from these kind of approaches, and where the landscape is totally designed to be productive but doesn't take so much energy as traditional agriculture to do it. Yeah.
Can I just add something? I'm not a smallholder, but I do grow stuff in my garden. I'm lucky enough to have a large enough garden to grow some food, and I think gardens are going to be a massive resource in the future. Food is an enormous issue with peak oil. Someone on Radio 4 once described oil as just industrial agriculture as a way of turning oil into food. So grow as much as you can yourself.
Okay, we've probably got time for one or two more questions. What time do we finish?
12.
12, yeah? Okay, so we've got 2 minutes. One more question then.
Hi, my name's Belinda and I'm from Canada. And I just had a question for you. You mentioned energy efficient cars, and I don't really know too much about that. But I've heard the argument made that these cars exist and could be accessible to the public. However, it would be terrible for the oil companies and the economy and in general the global market, because they wouldn't be making the maximum amount of money, but rather would be losing. So, and I also realized that it would cost a lot to make these solar powered cars or energy efficient cars. But why aren't we all driving these now?
Okay. My first car was a Fiat 127 25-odd years ago, and I think I did about 20-odd to the gallon. I still drive a car today, but it does about 50. So there's been a huge sort of change over the last sort of generation. Cars have got much, much better. And there are cars around now which can do 70 or 80 miles to the gallon. There is a kind of myth of the kind of the car which does 200 to the gallon and runs on water, which I don't think exists. But electric cars are generally more efficient in terms of the amount of energy used overall. But there's problems with them. You know, the lithium batteries, there's a shortage of lithium, those kind of things. Solar-powered cars, yeah, all these things can help. But we are not going to cope with this problem by thinking we can maintain our current lifestyles and all drive around. We've got to get used to driving less, using less, making our lives less dependent on travelling around all the time. That is where we've got to go.
I'll just add the reason why they're not electric cars aren't millions of them on the road is because they cost a lot more money. And we detail in the book, our editor told us to do the economics on it, and it's quite interesting because you have to drive for at least another 10 years at average driving distance in this country to make it worthwhile buying one. Mm-hmm. But of course, if no one buys one, then they won't. They won't sell, and they won't. Mm. The prices won't come down. Mm. So it's a bit like photovoltaics, where the prices have plummeted as the feed-in tariff has brought them down. So, I have misgivings about cars. We cover this in the book. You know, there's someone in my church who has mental problems who was hit by a car and was perfectly normal before they were hit by a car. They could, you know, could have been. They weren't hit by an electric car because they didn't exist, but they could have done. And the car in our culture has been far too dominant. And I think we want to.
I made an appeal in the book, really, to get away from this dominance. It's ruined our architecture in our cities, and there are other reasons to drive less, not just environmental ones. Mm. And cars take a lot of energy to make, and that's in the book is quite surprising.
Just going to finish off by mentioning a small village called Teotihuacan. I don't know if anyone's heard of it. It sounds like it's somewhere on the South Island of New Zealand, perhaps the sort of place where they might have filmed part of the Hobbit film or something like that. But it's not that. Teotihuacan is actually an acronym, the end of the world as we know it. And that's where some people think we are headed with this whole peak oil thing. But it seems to me we are only headed there if we choose not to, you know, if we don't choose to turn away. We have a choice to live differently. We have a choice to engineer our lives in a different way so that we could avoid problems in the future. It seems to me that each one of us is given a kind of God-given creativity and individuality that we need as we together try and find a path through the difficult times ahead. So it seems to me what we need to do is this. We need to develop a vision for what our lifestyle, what our church and what our community could look like in the years ahead. And then with God's help, we need to make that happen. That's the end of our talk. If you want to come and chat to us more, if you've got more questions, come and meet us in G-Books at 1 p.m. Thanks very much for coming this morning.
Thank you very much for freezing along with us.